This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends. David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Before he was elected president, Barack Obama was being interviewed by Charlie Gibson. And he said, if you don't have enough self-awareness to see the element of megalomania involved in thinking you can be president, then you probably shouldn't be president. I think there's a slight madness to thinking that you should be the leader of the free world. That remark really stuck with me, and it was on my mind after I finished talking recently with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., son of an attorney general, nephew of President John Kennedy. Kennedy has announced that he's running for the Democratic nomination for 2024.
I've come here today to announce my candidacy for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. My mission over the next 18 months of this campaign.
With no prominent elected Democrat challenging Joe Biden, Kennedy is polling around 8 to 21%, which is more than enough to cause at least some alarm for Biden, whose popularity ratings are low and whose age is what it is. Formerly a supporter of President Biden, Kennedy was motivated to run by a belief, this is what he told me, that the White House had directed social media platforms to ban him. For many years now, Kennedy has been roiling with conspiracy theories. Vaccines cause autism. Drugs like Prozac might be causing the increase in school shootings. Toxic chemicals might contribute to children becoming transgender. And there's more. He wrote an entire book about Anthony Fauci, accusing Fauci of helping, and I'm quoting here, to orchestrate and execute 2020's historic coup d'etat against Western democracy, unquote. These are ideas that anybody can find on the internet, and let's face it, many people do. But Kennedy's pedigree makes him a particularly influential conduit for disinformation. Robert Kennedy Jr. is approaching 70. He has never held or run for public office. He had a career as a conservationist and as a litigator. And so I asked him, what made him the ideal candidate for what is arguably the most consequential job on the planet?
Well, I don't know that I'm the ideal candidate to replace him. But what it seems to me that the country is going in a very bad direction, and that nobody else is really stepping up to change it in a way that, you know, it's pretty clear to me that it needs to be changed. I think I'm qualified for the job because to me, the fulcrum of the problem is this corrupt collusion between government and corporate power. And the place where the rubber meets the road is in the public agencies and the regulatory agencies. And I've spent my 40-year career litigating against those agencies, and I understand how they work. I understand how that dynamic occurred. And I understand, I think I'm in better shape probably than anybody else in the country to unravel it.
There are a lot of lawyers in the country. There are a lot of people who are concerned about corporate power and its relationship to government. But you're running for president, the most complicated and powerful office, even on the face of the earth, conceivably. So it sounds to me like we'd be well served by hearing more specifics.
I've spent many, many years suing big polluters in the oil industry, the coal industry, and the chemical industry, but probably about 20% of my cases were against EPA. And in many cases, there were people who were running the key branches of the agency that had more of a loyalty to the industries that they were supposed to regulate than to the American public. And they had become essentially sock puppets of the industries they're supposed to regulate. I spent 20 years doing agricultural law, suing large food processors and meat factories like Smithfield Food, Tyson's Food, Purdue, Monsanto.
And in your estimation, that experience as a litigator, as a lawyer, makes you qualified to essentially run all that's under the purview of the President of the United States, to be Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, to direct foreign policy, to appoint the heads of all the major agencies. You're approaching 70 years old, and you've never been in any kind of a major public office. How do you reconcile that?
I've been around government and studying government since I was a little boy. I went to the 1960 convention. I've been to most of the conventions since. I've been, you know, the election that you mentioned with my uncle, Edward Kennedy. I ran the southern states for him in that election. I've been involved in almost every presidential election during the last 60 years. I began writing about foreign policy when I was 19 years old. My first article was for The Atlantic. And I've written, you know, landmark articles during that time.
But experience in campaigns and being at conventions is not the same as either being involved in the making of policy, either as an executive or as a legislator or as a governor. So are you saying that really that kind of experience is not necessary to be president of the United States? The one president that I can think of that hasn't had any experience at that level is Donald Trump.
Well, there's nothing in the United States Constitution that says that you have to go to Congress first and then Senate second, or be a governor before you're elected to the presidency of the United States.
Or even mayor of a small town, but you haven't done any of it. Do you think that that is irrelevant experience?
I think my life experience is absolutely relevant.
Mr. Kennedy, you're running as a Democrat for president, and I wonder who in the Democratic Party do you feel is kindred to you? Obviously not Joe Biden, but AOC or Joe Manchin, or are you something new entirely? How would you define your ideology?
I'm something old. I'm a Kennedy Democrat. Mm-hmm. I believe in labor unions. I believe in a strong, robust middle class. I believe in racial justice, in policies that are going to actually help the people, the lowest people on the totem pole.
I don't think Joe Biden would disagree with any of that.
Well, and why did he do the lockdowns? Lockdowns were robbed $4 trillion from the middle class and the poor in this country and transferred it to the super rich. We created 500 new billionaires, a billionaire a day,
Do you think he did lockdowns, or politicians did lockdowns, in order directly to enrich billionaires? That was the goal?
I think that if they cared about the middle class in this country, they wouldn't have done it. They wouldn't have shut down businesses without due process, without just compensation.
They made mistakes, or they were carrying out some kind of perfidious plot?
No, I think that they made mistakes, which disqualifies them from continuing to do that job.
Something we should note here. While the pandemic bailout did cost the U.S. about $4 trillion, the figure he cites of nearly 500 people becoming billionaires, that's a global figure, not just Americans. The majority of those billionaires actually were in China. Kennedy's candidacy for the Democratic nomination is being welcomed by figures who aren't exactly friends of the Democratic Party. Donald Trump has praised him. Tucker Carlson and Alex Jones have too. Some of his talking points on the campaign trail would certainly appeal to a MAGA audience. He said, for example, that cartels in Mexico are running U.S. immigration policy. When I raised the subject of Donald Trump in particular, Kennedy changed the subject as quickly as possible.
Listen, I think, I am not a fan of Trump's. I saw his cowardice at the beginning of his administration when he appointed me to run a vaccine safety commission and then took $1 million from Pfizer and killed the commission. I'm not a friend of President Trump's, but I think we can criticize people on policy.
Why do you think why do you think Donald Trump admires you?
I think because
I'm not suspicious of that.
You know what? My job is not to drive people apart. My job, I think what you guys have decided that you're going to do in the press, which is to create this polarization and to feed the anger and to feed the hatred and to feed the and to conduct ad hominem attacks and the name calling. And I don't want to do that. We need to end that in this country. We need somebody who's going to bridge the gap between Americans.
Yes, but so polarization is a bad thing. I understand that, but you're a critical.
You belong to a class of elite journalists who once were the guardians of the press and the protectors of American values and the American middle class, and you now consider those people to be deplorable.
I don't consider anybody to be deplorable in this. That's somebody else's vocabulary. And let's talk about the word elite for a second. You come from a highly privileged background, eclipsing mine by some order of magnitude. Isn't it a little rich for you to be calling people elites?
Well, when I use the word elite, I'm talking about the people who are inside the Beltway defending the people that the press figures who are supposed to be speaking truth to power, mm-hmm. but instead have become propagandists for the government and who view their job as quashing dissent and quashing, political criticism of the government that they're supposed to be actually criticizing.
Do you really believe this, or do you think it plays well?
Of course I believe it.
Now, I'm finding it curious and maybe even disturbing that some of your early admirers include Trumpists like Steve Bannon, Michael Flynn, Roger Stone. Do you welcome that? Or do you think maybe, just maybe, someone like that is delighted that a strong Democratic opponent will wound Joe Biden and in the long run help Donald Trump?
I'm trying to unite the country, David. I'm not going to do what you do, which is to pick out people and say that they're evil, they should be canceled or whatever. I think the kind of tribalism that you're advocating is poisonous to our country. I think it's toxic. It's created a polarization, a division in this country that is more dangerous than at any time since the American Civil War.
Isn't there a difference between disagreement on, isn't there a disagreement?
And what you're trying to get me to do now mm-hmm. is to lash out against other Americans. And what I'm saying is, I don't agree with what those people represent in many parts of their lives. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with it, and I don't like it. But I'm still going to talk to them. I'm not going to cancel them.
Now, my question wasn't whether Steve Bannon should be canceled, whatever that would mean in this context. I asked whether Kennedy welcomes his support in his own presidential race. but Kennedy might be talking less about Bannon here or Alex Jones than about himself.
If you ask me what about something that Alex Jones did, I will tell you it's what he did with the Sandy Hook is reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to permanently write him off as a human being. People are redeemable. I believe in redemption. You know, I got an opportunity for redemption in my own life. And there's plenty of people who have good excuse to write me off forever.
Tell me about that.
I believe in redemption.
Tell me about your own sense of redemption. I think you're probably referring to problems with addiction.
Yeah, I mean, I was a heroin addict for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I'm lucky to be alive. And like I said, you know, people have plenty of reason to write me off forever because of the way I conducted my lives during that 14-year period.
What's been the effect of, and we all know people who, friends, family, who have suffered from addiction, and it's a lifelong struggle. What's been the effect on your life to this day on it? I think I heard you say recently that you go to 9 meetings a week.
Yeah, I mean, the recovery program is an important part of my life. It's an important part of keeping me mentally and physically and spiritually fit. So, you know, I focus on all those things, and it's important to me. I mean, in many ways, that my addiction was a gift because it gave me a blueprint. The recovery from the addiction gave me a blueprint about how to live the rest of my life. And, you know, you talk about, you know, you keep wanting to focus on why don't I hate on this guy more? Why don't I hate on this person more? And my program tells me not to do that. I'm not supposed to be doing that.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is running for president as a Democrat. Our conversation continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off.
While some colleges ramped up police presence on campus, others responded to protest against Israel's war in Gaza by giving students a seat at the table. I'm Kai Wright, and on the next Notes from America, meet a young negotiator from Brown University. We'll explore what divestment actually means and how views of victory in this movement vary depending on where you sit.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm speaking today with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Kennedy is best known as an anti-vaccine activist. He sees himself as a singular warrior against collusion between greedy corporations and corrupt government agencies. In Kennedy's case, his obsession with conspiracy, his tendency to see it just about everywhere, might have an explanation rooted in his life story. I don't think it's a great leap of psychoanalysis to suppose that his thinking, his psyche, was likely shaped from early on by unimaginable tragedy as well as enormous privilege. He's certain that the CIA conspired to assassinate his uncle, John F. Kennedy, and he believes that the CIA might have been behind the murder of his father 5 years later.
I don't think anybody who has looked at my uncle's murder seriously believes that the Warren Commission was correct. And, you know, the evidence today is, listen, I'm a trial lawyer. I've tried hundreds of cases. I can guarantee you, looking at this case, that I could prove that my uncle's death was caused by the CIA. I have enough evidence right now, without any depositions, to go to prove that my uncle's death was the result of a conspiracy and that the CIA was involved not only in the original conspiracy, but in the 60-year cover-up and continues to maintain the cover-up. There's still
What was the CIA's motivation?
In my uncle's death, well, it depends. I mean, most of the people who were involved, like David Hadley Phillips and Howard Hunt, you know, people who, you know, Howard Hunt gave a confession to it, and they were angry at my uncle. Their initial anger came when he failed to go into the Bay of Pigs, when he failed to invade and provide air cover for the Bay of Pigs, which they consider a betrayal. They had trained those men. Those men were dying on the beach, and they, at that point, they believed that my uncle was a traitor to the United States. When my uncle and my father halted the raids on Cuba after the missile crisis, they agreed as part of their agreement with Khrushchev during the missile crisis to halt the raids from Miami by Alpha 66 and the other groups that were going into Cuba. To halt them, and you know, my uncle sent the Coast Guard down and the CIA and confiscated the boats.
The conversation about the assassinations went on for quite some time, and it went into detail about ballistics and second shooters and the like. And of course, there's a huge body of literature disputing the accepted historical account of those events. But Kennedy endorses other conspiracy theories that are scientifically wrong and politically, humanly dangerous. I'll be very honest with you. I don't want to engage you in the deep detail on the question of vaccinations and your belief stated in the past that vaccines are responsible for autism to some degree. I have to say, I have a quite severely autistic child, and while no one would want to know the cause of autism more than I do, I frankly think, with respect, that you've been slinging around a lot of theories over time that don't have any great credibility among science, among scientists, and do a lot of harm to a lot of people. And I want to ask you this question: do you not have any second thoughts about this? You said that you would. You seem to be altering your rhetoric about this very recently. That you just want to see vaccines tested. You seem to be shifting on this without quite saying so.
I've never shifted on it. I've said from the beginning that I got involved with this issue, that's what I wanted. I've always said I'm not anti-vaccine. I want good testing for the vaccines and I want good science. So, you know, I don't necessarily believe all the scientists because I can read science myself. You say that scientists don't believe that. Well, you know, the scientists one point all believe that the COVID vaccine prevented transmission. And when I said, no, they don't prevent transmission because I read the monkey studies in May of 2020. And I saw that the amount of the concentration of the virus in the nasal pharynx of the vaccinated monkey was identical to the unvaccinated monkeys. And I said, these vaccines should be dead in the water. They won't prevent transmission. And I was deplatformed for spouting conspiracy theories. And because all the scientists said they're going to prevent transmission. So, you know, I don't necessarily believe all the scientists because I can read science myself. That's what I do for a living. I read science critically. That's how I win cases. And I've read the science on autism, and I can tell you if you want to know, you know, where you need. I mean, one thing, David, you got to answer this question. If it didn't come, the vaccines, then where is it coming from? Why isn't anybody telling us that?
Guns and school shootings in this country are rampant, and they're a tragedy and at a level like at no other time. Recently, you've suggested that SSRIs and benzos and other drugs, that's your phrase, might be responsible for America's school shooting problem. Where are you getting that from? You told the Times recently that assault rifles clearly make the world more dangerous and we should figure out how to limit the impact. But then you said there's something else happening. Why would that something else be, of all the many things that have arrived in modern life, why would they be benzos, SSRIs, Prozac, and other drugs?
Well, you know, this is, you know, after the Columbine shooting, which was one of the first big shootings, there was a lawsuit in which I think five of the Columbine victims sued on the basis of the SSRIs, and those suits ultimately settled in favor of the plaintiffs. So, you know, this is an issue that people have been looking at for many, many years. And unfortunately, it's really hard to understand what the impact is because we don't have good data. And the reason we don't have good data is because of HIPAA. So for reporters who might be interested in following that trail, it's virtually impossible for them to find out if a shooter was taking benzos or was taking SSRIs. I mean, why, you know, the reason that...
So it's not something you have proof of, it's something that you're injecting into the conversation, as it were.
Excuse me?
So it's not something you have evidence of, but rather that it's something that you want to bring up as a possibility.
Well, I do think that we should figure out, you know, why this is happening besides, because there's been guns all around. I mean, when I was a kid, there were gun clubs at the schools. And kids were bringing rifles to schools every day. And nobody ever considered that a problem. People weren't going into classrooms and shooting kids. And there's other nations.
I understand that. But I guess what I'm saying is that the presidency of the United States, it's very, very sensitive what comes out of a president's mouth about any issue, whether it's race or the economy, to kind of just inject into the bloodstream, into the conversation of the United States, that SSRIs and benzos and other drugs might be responsible for the rash of school shootings in this country, which is so tragic. Isn't that problematic to just say stuff like that without any real evidence?
I've said there's a lot of things that should be investigated. We should look at video games. We should look at social media. We should do science on that. The NIH is supposed to be doing that kind of science. It is a $42 billion a year budget. Why don't we have the answer to those questions? They can penetrate HIPAA. They can figure this out and tell us the truth. Why aren't they doing that?
Why aren't they doing that? Well, one reason might be that for almost 20 years, NRA allies in Congress have blocked federal funding for research on gun violence. But that's just not Kennedy's way of thinking. That's a conspiracy that is just too out in the open, too political, too public. Robert Kennedy Jr. voted for Joe Biden in 2020. And when I asked him why he decided to turn around and challenge him, he pointed first to the war in Ukraine. Like some on the far left and also on the right, he believes that the West and NATO provoked Russia into the invasion in the first place. When I asked him what alternate sources of media he prefers, he immediately mentioned that he reads a blog by Douglas MacGregor, a retired Army colonel who's sympathetic to the Russian government view of the invasion of Ukraine. Liz Cheney and others say that MacGregor represents the Putin wing of the GOP. President Biden immediately put the U.S. at the center of a NATO policy of helping to arm and protect Ukraine. If you had been president a year ago February, would you have done the same, or would you have let Putin act as he had hoped by arresting or killing Zelensky and installing a puppet regime? What would you have done as president if faced with an invasion of Ukraine?
I wouldn't be moving. I wouldn't be threatening. I would do what Putin had asked very reasonably, is that we give a pledge not to put NATO into the Ukraine. And I don't believe there would have been a war.
I'm asking a different question. I'm asking, if you had been president a year ago February, setting aside the long prelude to this conflict, if he had invaded, what would you have done?
I don't think if I was president, the invasion would have occurred, because I would have made the assurance that Putin was asking for. It was absolutely irresponsible not to make that assurance. Putin has a legitimate national security interest in keeping the NATO out of Ukraine, because he knows that we put Aegis missile systems in Romania and Poland as soon as we wrap them into the Ukraine. And he doesn't want missile systems 400 miles from Moscow any more than we would want missile systems 400 miles from Washington, D.C., and we would invade Canada or Cuba or Mexico if anybody tried to do that. He asked something that was eminently reasonable, that we would pledge not to put the NATO into the Ukraine. And, you know, for generations, our diplomats have warned American leadership and warned the neocons who now run the White House that if we move NATO into the Ukraine, it would force the Russians to have a violent response.
Force them to have a violent response.
I'm not saying that Putin didn't have any options, but the Russian leadership, not just Putin, but the Russian leadership since 1992 were warning us, do not do that.
If you were president now, you would withdraw aid to Ukraine. As American president, would support the end of military funding for the defense of Ukraine to Zelensky.
I would end the war. I would negotiate a peace.
And what would that peace look like?
Well, you never know that until you negotiate.
I understand.
But would
you allow a peace that had much of eastern Ukraine and Crimea remain in Russian hands?
You know, I don't know what I would negotiate. I know that the Russians had come to two different peace agreements, both of which were eminently reasonable. And so
I'm asking is, what would be a reasonable peace?
Well, the answer to that question is strategic ambiguity. If I intend to be president of the United States, I'm not going to tell my adversary what my final negotiating position would be.
What about the voter?
I'm going to negotiate it. You negotiate a treaty.
In other words, in Vietnam, when there was a political campaign, your father said exactly what he would have done vis-a-vis the United States in Vietnam. And he had, as did Eugene McCarthy, and he differed with Hubert Humphrey and Lyndon Johnson. Why is it unreasonable
for
you to—
I'm telling you exactly what I would do, and I'm telling you what I consider fair, which is I consider the terms of the Minsk Accords fair. And that's what Russia already offered to sign. Now, you know, we have worsened our position in the debate clearly through these ill-advised policies of encouraging war, of refusing to negotiate, of refusing to even talk to our adversaries. You know, my uncle, President Kennedy, again and again told the country, You've got to put yourself into the shoes of your adversary. And he did that with Khrushchev. He put in a hotline in our home in Massachusetts and in the White House so that he could pick up the phone and call Moscow, because he was scared of provoking a nuclear response. Mm-hmm. And today, Russia has more nuclear weapons than we do. We are toying with Armageddon here. These leaders ought to be talking to each other, and they aren't. And that is not the fault. And that is the fault of our administration.
Robert Kennedy, I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is running for the presidential nomination as a Democrat. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
2 years later, he left the settlement. He took the bus heading north and then hitchhiked on the back of a repurposed U.S. Army truck that was filled with others like him who all said the same thing. They were heading home.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Paul Yoon's short story, Valley of the Moon, is about a man trying to rebuild a life after the devastation of the Korean War. And Yoon read the story for the New Yorker.
They all said this knowing that there wasn't much left for them to go home to. Still, it felt good to say this to one another, to say without saying that they had survived. And as the truck made stops, they exchanged cartons of cigarettes, small sacks of grain, shoelaces, pieces of cloth. Then they asked one another where home was and how far from the border they would be living. They asked what refugee settlement others had found themselves in, or how many settlements and for how long, or if they had been in one at all. They asked one another what they had done before the war, and they asked one another their names and how old they were. His name was Tong Su. He was, like so many of them, from a farming family, and he was 31 years old. Crowded together in the back of the bumpy truck, they asked him about his eye patch. He was honest and told them that when he first arrived at the settlement, he was stabbed during a scuffle. Some of them showed him the toes or the fingers they were missing from frostbite during winter. Tong Su did the same. He was missing a toe, and then they made a joke about how maybe what they had lost would turn up now that the war was over. Tong Su, I will remember you, they all said when it was his turn to get off the truck. And he said that he would remember them too, knowing that he wouldn't. When he reached the mountains, he walked. He walked along the road until he reached a part that had been bombed out, and then he walked into the woods and climbed the steep slope. A sack of rice grains was strapped to his back with the moth-eaten wool blanket he had used for sleeping. Hidden among the grains was a large amount of money he had taken from the inside wall of the shanty, where he and a dozen others slept. Money that belonged to a man who had died a year earlier. In Tong Su's chest pocket, tucked inside a handkerchief, were vegetable seeds. He climbed steadily without rest, using the trees that had survived to pull himself up. He climbed for almost an hour, zigzagging up the slope. When he eventually reached the crest, he could see below, almost halfway down the other side, the small farmhouse where he had been born and where his parents had most likely died. He didn't know. It was more than half in ruin, as was most of the land, the soil upturned and dried out. Deep craters were everywhere, pieces of rubber and metal. He spotted the bones of animals, some of them likely belonging to the goats that used to roam here. And he wasn't sure why, but he spent the rest of the day gathering the bones and burying them down in the valley, even before he stepped inside. When he did, it had grown dark, with only the moonlight to guide him through this house he had not seen in a lifetime, where, in the one room where the walls remained intact, he found nothing but a cup on the floor brimming with dirt and rainfall.
Paul Yoon, reading from his story, Valley of the Moon, published in The New Yorker. You can hear the whole story on our podcast, The Writer's Voice. The rise in healthcare costs and the crushing medical debts that follow from that are a problem that long predates COVID, although the pandemic certainly contributed. It long predates the recent trend toward inflation, too. For so many Americans, the stream of late notices and threatening voicemails never quite ends. Two former debt collectors got together to try to tackle the problem from a very unexpected direction. Staff writer Sheila Kolhatkar, who covers business and finance for The New Yorker, looked at how one small church in North Carolina erased more than $4 million of other people's debts. Here's Sheila.
RIP Medical Debt was founded in 2014 by two former debt collection executives. It's based in New York, and the organization gathers up contributions and donations and uses them to buy out bundles of outstanding medical debt, and then pays off that debt, which can have life-changing consequences for some of the people who owe money for medical bills. In order to try and understand this a little better, I spoke with Reverend John Jackman, the pastor of Trinity Moravian Church in North Carolina. Tell me about Trinity Moravian Church and the community where you serve.
Trinity Moravian Church is a little over 100 years old. Our church is absolutely an average-sized church. If you take the average attendance of churches across the country, you know, there are really very few mega churches. Most churches are attendance of under 100, and we're around 75 or 80 on a Sunday. And if you draw a one-mile circle around the church, the population is one-third Black, one-third white, one-third Latino. And at the turn of the century, I'm talking about going into 2000, the neighborhood was in decay. We had crack houses a block from the church, and the congregation wrestled with whether or not to kind of sell the building and move out to the suburbs and build a new church the way many congregations have, city congregations have. And they voted overwhelmingly that they wanted to stay and minister to that neighborhood. And so the commitment's very deep.
How did you first hear about RIP medical debt?
I had read about it before the pandemic, and I thought, oh, you know, what a genius idea. And during the pandemic, all of a sudden, we were facing the possibility with COVID of many people with medical bills that they couldn't pay. And so what we did was we set up an account with RIP Medical Debt specifically for our area. We had them do a survey of our counties. The area here is North Carolina Triad, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, High Point area. We had them do a survey of all the counties in this area to see how much debt was available for purchase. We set up a campaign to raise the approximate amount of money they think it will take to buy the debt at wholesale. So the first time we did it, our board said, let's try this. And we needed to raise $5,000. So our board said, look, let's try it. See if we can raise $5,000 and see what happens. The level of interest was so high. When we hit the $5,000 fundraising mark, we went back to RIP Medical Debt, and they went to auction, and they were able to buy $1.2 million in medical debt in this area with that money.
Wow!
And helped about 1,000 families. And I mean, this was just astonishing. I had to, I don't know how many times I had to explain to our members again and again how it was we were able to buy this staggering amount of debt with this little amount of money. But also RIP medical debt, then they will generate letters to each household explaining what has happened and that the debt has been purchased and then forgiven. And it's removed from the credit report. It's just wiped out.
It sounds like a lot of your conversations now revolve around medical debt. Is this something you ever imagined would happen to you
no,
as a pastor?
We had no idea. I mean, we have undertaken, you know, a number of projects in the past, but there's never been anything quite like this. I just went to a store yesterday and to buy something for the church. And the lady looked at the credit card and said, "Oh, you're the church that buys the medical debt." And I've never met her before. And that happens all the time now.
After I talked with Pastor John, I spoke with Allison Sesso, who became the president and CEO of RIP Medical Debt in 2020. How much debt has RIP Medical Debt abolished overall?
So we're inching closer to $9 billion, helping over 5 million people.
Before we jump right into it, can you explain a little bit about how did RIP Medical Debt come into being?
So there are people in the world that are debt buyers. And so what they do is they go out to the world and they try to buy various kinds of debt. It's medical debt. It's electrical bills. It's all kinds of debt.
Mortgages.
Exactly. All these kinds of things. So they try to buy that debt. And then they, in order to make a profit, they have to buy it for super cheap, because what they're doing essentially is making a bet, right? Like they're saying, okay, I'm going to put this investment in, I'm going to buy this debt on the chance that I'm going to collect some of it from some people. And the people don't have to necessarily, you can cut deals with people, right? Because you paid pennies on the dollar. So if someone owes $10,000, you can cut a deal that they owe you two, and you're up still for that particular debt. But in order for this whole thing to become profitable for an entity, they have to make sure that they're pricing it super dirt cheap, because the majority of people, especially with medical debt, can't pay.
Who qualifies to get help from your organization?
Yeah, so we're actually totally blind to like any attributes of the individual beyond their income situation. Mm-hmm. So we look at their income, and if they are 400% of poverty or below, they will qualify, or if the debt is 5% or more of the person's individual income. And the reason why we pick that number is people within that range struggle. There aren't a lot. They don't qualify for Medicaid. They don't qualify for a lot of the subsidies. And so the medical part of their budgets is where they struggle the most.
Okay, that makes sense. And once you explain the context of the people below a certain point are covered by Medicaid, so one would assume they are much less likely
to be
That's experiencing
right.
medical debt. Like
That's
everything
right.
that they do has to be.
For the most part, yes. So we buy that data and then we do an analysis, and everyone that qualifies, we will pull all those people out. We will match the donation to those debts, and we will send letters out to all of those individuals and say, you have had your debt abolished. You do not have to take any action. They do not have to take any action on the outset or anything until they get that letter. They don't even know that this happened. And we encourage them to come back to us and tell their stories. And that's part of what we want to do. We want people to sort of break this intense feeling that that they did something wrong, and to point to the system through storytelling.
I was curious to know who the donors are to your organization. What can you say about that?
Churches, obviously, are significant. Lots of individuals. You know, a lot of donations are small in nature. Sometimes there are people who we've helped who pay it forward and give us, you know, $10. Individuals do crowdsourcing campaigns that they stand up. So they either do it on Facebook, or they'll join a race and do a run and raise some money from their friends and family. But we also have corporations who give to us, you know, as corporate social responsibility.
So it's very odd, this idea that these debts are trading so cheaply. I mean, it is astonishing when you look at how much money you can raise, and then how many millions of dollars of medical debts can be retired. Why is that?
It's because the people who owe the debts can't pay. And the debt buyers know that, right? Medical debt, you have way less control over. You just don't have the ability to sign on the bottom line. I mean, you're sick, you go to the hospital, and your insurance situation is what it is at the time that you go.
Plenty of people with insurance end up with
That's
big
right.
medical
you're
debts.
Out of network, or the doctor, you know, you don't know you're sick, right? So I think that that's the thing. So the majority of people that are in these portfolios are people who are 400% of poverty or below, which is why we are able to qualify them. And so the chances of them being able to pay are very low. So that naturally pushes down the price, because, again, the bet that the debt buyer is taking is that they'll be able to recoup it. Well, you can't get blood from a stone.
So it's a bit of a gamble that the debt buyer is making, that maybe some small number of these people will repay. But basically, it reflects the fact that these debts are almost worthless because they're probably not going to get paid out.
That's right. But they do hope that people's financial situation will change. Or, you know, and unfortunately, some of them, they'll put them on payment plans. So people are paying like $100 a month, or they're trying to, you know, get their way out of this. They can take their assets, right? They could take them to court. They could have judgments on them. So people will lose their houses, their cars. They'll have their wages garnished. So there's some real tactics that they could use once they own the debt, as can hospitals, to recoup this loss, which is really the part that is really problematic, I think, at the end of the day.
The first time I heard about RIP medical debt, I thought, wow, this is really innovative. It's sort of like a Kickstarter campaign for people's medical bills. And it's really clever the way they're combining data analytics with their knowledge of the debt markets and using that to really help people. On the other hand, the fact that we need a Kickstarter system for people to pay off medical bills is very disturbing. It's a sign of just how broken the healthcare system is here. It's really a Band-Aid solution. It is trying to address problems all the way at the end of the line rather than addressing the systemic problems that caused the whole situation in the first place.
One of the interesting things is I've done interviews with several international papers because the rest of the world looks at us and says, how come you haven't figured this out yet? they're kind of baffled by this idea that people could be so burdened by medical debt, because it doesn't happen in other industrialized countries.
Well put. The concept of forgiveness of debt has deep roots throughout the Bible, and I wondered,
yes,
as a Christian pastor, what is the significance of this idea of forgiving debt?
Well, I think people forget that. So if you go back into Leviticus in the Old Testament, there are a lot of laws about how you treat the poor, about how you treat the stranger, how you treat the sojourner who's crossing over your land. There are rules for people in terms of not harvesting all the food, so to leave some of the food in the field for the poor. And there's a section that we based our name on about the Day of Jubilee, which was a special day every 50th year that all debts were to be forgiven, slaves were to be freed. It was to be an entire cultural reset. And we don't know if that ever really happened historically, but it is spelled out in Leviticus, and we use that as the model. So we're going in for families that we know cannot deal with these things. We're taking the weight off of them.
Pastor Jackman, thank you so much for being here.
Okay, thank you so much, Sheila.
The New Yorker's Sheila Kolhatkar speaking to Pastor John Jackman of Trinity Moravian Church in Winston-Salem. Sheila also talked with Allison Sesso of RIP Medical Debt. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Toon Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Imputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keefline, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.